before I start, I want to, in the spirit of the hymn that we've just sung, leave one thought with you. And I ask you to ponder this as we study the sanctuary in the book of Daniel. We would not be here without Jesus Christ.
Amen.
Now, I also feel compelled to address my scholarly friends that are in the audience today, that have expressed their disappointment enough of not being able to attend my lecture yesterday at the ADS meeting. And I'm afraid their joy to see me here and address this group with the same topic, apparently, I have to disappoint you a little bit in that, because it will be quite different what I'm presenting today. So if you're interested in my scholarly paper, then you can come to me and I will arrange for you to receive a copy. I grew up in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Even when I was younger, my father told me that I was a fifth-generation Adventist. And when I was in Germany just a few weeks ago, I asked him about that again and told him I would like to know exactly how this goes. I mean, this must go back pretty far. And he told me exactly, and I wrote it down for further reference for myself. Now, why am I telling you this? Because I want you to know that I've grown up with this church and with the love for this church and for the teachings of this church. In my early years, when I was a kid, I heard the stories of Daniel in the children's division of the Sabbath school. And I loved them, as you did when you heard them. Can you still remember that? When you had the privilege of being a child in the SDA church, you probably remember that. Later, I heard about the prophecies, chapters 7 to 12. But I have to confess that much later in my life, I understood the relationship between the stories and the prophecies. And I want to give credit to the man who helped me understand this, and this is Mark Finley. When he came out with his Daniel seminar, and you probably are familiar with the Daniel seminar, and much more so with Mark Finley, who is a very public figure by now, when he came out with this Daniel seminar, I was privileged to be one of the first people in Europe to hold a Daniel seminar. And I can still remember, I was just starting in my ministry, as I was sitting there pondering the seminar and the contents. And as I was thrilled and fascinated to see that these stories are not just children's stories, but they're interrelated with the prophecies that come later in the book. That they answer, that the whole book answers the two questions that are so important. The number one question that we ask most of the time, and that is, when will it all happen? When is the time of the end? That's the prophecy part. But there's also the question, how shall we then live? And that's the story part. I was fascinated to see the value of the interrelationship of all the parts of the book. Why was that so fascinating for me? Because I was accustomed to the stereotyped approach. The stories are for the kids, the prophecies are more for the adults. Did you know that we have an SDA book of Daniel? It consists only of four chapters. It's the Reader's Digest version of the book of Daniel. And you could probably guess which chapters are in the book. Chapter 2, chapter 7, 8, and 9. Now, people today love Reader's Digest versions of almost everything. You know, there's even a Bible that is called the Reader's Digest Bible. And in Germany, they translate, of course, Reader's Digest is translated in so many languages, and of course in German too, and it's called the best of Reader's Digest in German. I like that. But are we willing to say chapters 2, 7 to 9 are the best of the book of Daniel? What I'm trying to say here is we need to take the whole book into account. We have to look at the whole book. Now, I hope that we've tried to do this here with this conference. And I don't want to do any less today. So that's the challenge before us. We have to look at the whole book, not just at parts of it. Now, I want to take up the challenge to look at the sanctuary in the book of Daniel. Now, when I would ask an ordinary Seventh-day Adventist, where do we find the sanctuary in the book of Daniel? What would the answer be? I hope so. Of course, Daniel 8:14. Now, that's a pretty easy question and a pretty easy answer, I would guess, because it's written there. I mean, the word itself occurs in Daniel 8:14. The sanctuary shall be cleansed after such and such a time. But there's more. There's more than just Daniel 8:14. We need a more comprehensive view of the sanctuary motif, as it were, and the book of Daniel itself, so that we can really make a judgment on how important the sanctuary motif, or the sanctuary itself for that matter, is. Now, how important is the sanctuary? Let me digress a little bit here before we go into the book of Daniel. I can still remember a minister's meeting a number of years ago, and I was called in as one of the professors at our school to talk about theology. And one of the phrases that I used was, the sanctuary is one of the most important, if not the most important, doctrine that we have. Now, I can still remember the looks on the faces of these pastors. They looked at me, this is a German saying now, as if I would come from another star. And of course, they challenged me on that. And you probably know how it is in Europe. You know, when you're challenged, you're really challenged. I mean, they don't package this as nicely as you do here. You know, I basically agree with you, but, you know, maybe I may add, you know, this is the way you do it here. But over there, just challenge you. They just shoot at you many times, not all the time. I don't want to generalize too much. Anyway, they challenged me on that, and they said, Jesus is the most important thing, the most important person, the most important doctrine that we have. Correct? Of course. Who would want to deny that? We've just sung about Jesus Christ. But do you see how nearsighted we sometimes are, that we do not see Christ in the sanctuary, that we keep these two things apart? And as far as I can go back in my memory, I can see how much I had to fight the idea of disassociating, dichotomizing, as it were, the doctrines from Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ and the doctrines cannot be separated. And that's a study on its own, of course, and I can't go too much into this. And the question that we sometimes have is, now isn't it enough to receive forgiveness from Jesus Christ? Why do we have to go through this seemingly elaborate process of a sanctuary? And you probably know how embarrassed we as Adventists sometimes can be when we want to try to explain the sanctuary to non-Adventists. Because they challenge us on this thing, and they say, now, why is this? My faith, my belief is much simpler than this. Now I want to pass by you an idea, and I really want you to think about it. Don't just accept it. And maybe you can challenge me on this later on. It's an idea that you might want to use in evangelism. I did the same, but I'm not claiming that this is the best thing, the best illustration. Have you ever done what I am very fond of doing? Looking, gazing in the starlit sky at night. I started doing that when I was a little kid. And I'm still as fascinated today as I was then. I was looking up in the sky, saying to myself, now, why am I here? What is this whole thing? This little planet, and as I grew up, I understood more about astronomy and all the things that are related to that. But then one day I learned that the stars that I look at, that the light that I see did not originate the moment I see it. Right? It needs time to travel here. So, supposedly, there is life on the stars that I see. I don't really know that. But let's take the Andromeda Nebula, M31, it's called by the astronomers. They now have corrected the figures lately, and they say it's 2.2 million light years away from us. Now, if that's too mind-boggling, just take another star that might be just 4.25 light years away. That's still far enough. Now, if there was light on this star, and there were people there, what would that mean if you would be able, with very keen eyes, with telescopic eyes, to see exactly what's going on there? Would you see what is going on there right now?
No.
No, you wouldn't. Now, please reverse the situation. Imagine that if people up there see the light from this little tiny planet Earth, and they could see everything that's going on here. Would they see what's going on here now? Well, we don't know that. Of course, I know my little idea, my little illustration is based on a presupposition, and that can be challenged. And that's the presupposition that they're in the same situation that we are, physically speaking. I realize that can be challenged. But let's just take it as an illustration. That would mean that sin, even if it is forgiven right now, is not over. Now, you might not like that idea. That means that the act of sin can still be seen if it's not taken care of. And this is exactly the chance that Satan tries to use for his own purposes. He will have, and I use a modern metaphor now, he will have a huge video screen there. And he will show, now, Father, you want to let this person into your kingdom? Just take a look at the screen for a minute. And there it is. I propose to you today that the sanctuary truth is there because Jesus tries to deal with the sin problem once and for all. He wants to do away with that. And so to speak, Jesus will hold his nail-scarred hand across the screen and nothing can be seen anymore. That's the reason why the sanctuary is so important. Now let's go back in the Old Testament. How did the sanctuary start? When you think about the sanctuary service and everything that pertains to it, there are certain categories, and they're actually very easy to detect. The first thing that you need for a sanctuary is the sacred location, is the place where it happens. When you go back in the Old Testament, the first location where it happened was the altar that was built. Then it was the tent tabernacle. And later on it was the temple. So you need a location. The second element, the second category that you have is the services, the rituals, the ceremonies that happen in the specific location take place in a certain time. So the sanctuary, and that's very understandably so, because we live in space and time, the sanctuary is in space and time. There are certain sacred times when things take place. Of course, there are objects. There are things connected with the sanctuary, with the cultic services. Cultic, one of these words that scholars use to describe the sanctuary in its wider horizon. There are persons officiating in the sanctuary. Personages that are related, that are associated with the sanctuary. And there are also rituals that are performed. And I would call them performance of sacred rituals, ceremonies, whatever you have connected with the sanctuary. Now I want to propose to you today that all these categories are present in the book of Daniel. And I hope to show when I'm through, after the few minutes that I have left, that the book of Daniel is imbued with sanctuary motifs, with themes that are related to the cultic life in ancient Israel. And what I really want to state is that Daniel, who wrote the book, was very much aware of the sanctuary services that he knew from back home. And that he wove that into the message of his book. And that it is more important for the overall theology of the book, for the message of the book, than we might have recognized until now. So I would like to look at one or two, maybe three, examples of sanctuary motifs in the book of Daniel. When you open the book of Daniel, I would like you to read with me in chapter 1. Thank you. In chapter 1, how the book starts out. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. So Daniel 1 verse 2 states that in the process of the conquest of Jerusalem, some of the articles of the house of God were carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, into the treasure house of his God. Now you can clearly see why it is worded that way. It's interesting that Daniel is not saying they were taken from the temple. I think on purpose he is saying from the house of God, because they are carried from the house of God into another God's house. To really make it very clear what is happening here. Of course, this was common practice at the time. And may be seen as a perfectly normal procedure, as some commentators put it. But I don't think that we have an incidental or irrelevant beginning of the book of Daniel here. On the contrary, it is the theme of the book and the key to everything that follows. The book of Daniel deals with the issues of superiority and defeat, of usurpation and worship. Therefore, it is not accidental that the removal of the temple vessel sets the stage, as it were, for the theme that is treated in the rest of the book. Some commentators do not want to attach too much significance to this, because they either see this as a mere preparation for the events in chapter 5, or as the usual taking of worthwhile plunder, as one puts it, which is therefore only of secondary concern. But I think there is much more. It is very clear in the context of Daniel 1, and from the understanding of temple in the ancient Near East, that the act of removing the articles from the Jerusalem temple and of placing them in a pagan shrine was viewed as the greatest victory for the conquering party. And together with the deportation of young Jews, a sign and pledge of the subjugation of Judah and its God under the dominion of the kings and gods of Babylon. The temple in ancient Israel, and in other peoples for that matter too, was seen as a dwelling place for God among the people. And that's part of the theology of the temple in the Old Testament. And this also included revelation and appearance of God, offering of sacrifices that were securing atonement, and God's presence as His faithfulness to the covenant promise. From the biblical data, we have to add, however, that the temple was understood as the place or center of the reign of God. And we have one text in Psalm 96 where this is confirmed. Honor and majesty are before Him. Strength and beauty are in His sanctuary. Tremble before Him all the earth. Say among the nations, the Lord reigns. He shall judge the peoples righteously. Now, we have to acknowledge the fact that in the Old Testament, Mount Zion was the location of the sanctuary and therefore often equated or at least associated with the sanctuary. There are numerous texts confirming the truth of the reign and also the judgment of God that comes from the sanctuary. The temple sometimes was even seen as the cosmic center of the universe, the place where heaven and earth converge, and thus from where God's control of the universe is effected. Now, not only the text that I quoted, but also the sanctuary service and Yom Kippur in particular present God's judgment taking place in or from the sanctuary. This is the way the Day of Atonement was understood in biblical times and also in Jewish interpretation. Thus, we have to conclude that one of the major theological meanings of the sanctuary was the reign of God. And this is demonstrated by the obvious significance that is attached to the removal of the vessels in Daniel 1. This is the message that we receive from the removal of the temple vessels in Daniel chapter 1. The removal of these vessels in its theological significance is intensified by their being brought into the house of Nebuchadnezzar's pagan god. It is very interesting to see that the Babylonians obviously felt that by removing the vessels from the house of the foreign god of the people that they had just conquered, they would conquer them completely, because they would by that show how much superior they were and how much superior their Babylonian gods were. So seen in the context of verse 1, which introduces the kingdom theme in the book of Daniel, this is a clear reference to the fact that here we do not only have a military conquest, but also the seizure of kingly powers and of religious prerogatives that belong to the true one God in heaven. And this theme of usurpation can be traced throughout the whole book, as through the book of Revelation for that matter as well. And this becomes also evident in Daniel 5, where Belshazzar desecrates the sacred temple vessels from Jerusalem even more by using them for an idolatrous feast. Daniel, as the spokesperson for God, denounces this act as a rebellion against the true God. Read it carefully, verse 23 in chapter 5. It's very clear. And he reminds Belshazzar of Nebuchadnezzar's arrogance and downfall, telling Belshazzar that he is on the same road to destruction. Now, this removal, the placement in a pagan temple, and the subsequent additional desecration in chapter 5, suggest more than just usurpation of royal dominion. Seeing these temple articles as being essential symbols of the sanctuary service, we have to conclude that here we also have the usurpation of divine prerogatives in granting salvation and atonement to man. The sanctuary is an integral part of worship, and it's not only attacked here, but also substituted with another house of God and another worship in chapter 5. Since there's a connection between sanctuary and judgment, we also have to recognize here the attempt by the enemy to usurp God's judgment. Interestingly enough, the desecration of the temple vessels by Belshazzar brings about immediate judgment from God, the Lord of the temple, for him and his kingdom, which emphasizes the significance of the king's action along the lines we have pointed out. Another example of sanctuary in the book of Daniel, which we might not have recognized as readily as we can today. When you open to chapter 10, a chapter that, as I indicated, is also not in our Reader's Digest version of the book, you will find that Daniel is in a state of mourning. The first verses indicate that very clearly. Now, in the course of chapter 10, there's one word used that is not used elsewhere in the whole book. It's only used here. It's a cultic term. It's the word to humble yourself in verse 12. That is what the heavenly being announces to him. He said to me, verse 12, "Do not fear, Daniel. For from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I've come because of your words." And I'm concerned now with this little word there, to humble yourself. This term in Hebrew, and I'm not particularly tempted to bother you with the Hebrew term here, occurs only here in the book, and it seems significant that this term belongs to the language of Yom Kippur, of the Day of Atonement, in Leviticus 16 and Leviticus 23. And you probably remember Leviticus 23 as well as in Leviticus 16, and it's announced that whoever does not humble himself, or as the King James translates, afflicts himself, will be cut off from the people of God. Let's just study this word a little more. When it comes to the meaning of the word, we can generally say that the words of this Hebrew root belong to a negatively shaped field of ideas or experiences. No neutral basic meaning is to be observed. The basic meaning then speaks of misery, pain, anguish, affliction, and also of oppression. The adjectival use of this term always depicts people in an oppressed, restricted situation, even close to death. For those who are in this misery, there's no hope anymore. This condition is the opposite of happiness, security, strength, and superiority. Many times this word is used for those who belong to the socially disadvantaged, those who call no piece of land their own, those who are poor because they are being oppressed. And one version of this root, one form of this root term, is used for designating the poor. The poor is one who has been humiliated, who finds himself in a stunted, humble, lowly position, the one who's bowed down. And this meaning is also attested in other ancient Near Eastern languages, so we can speak of a rather unambiguous meaning for this term. So there's a negative change of status of a person by applying physical or mental force. Therefore, we find this word in the context of committing a rape, whereby it is not so much brutal force which is emphasized here, but rather the public and legal degradation that leads to a loss of status, which is clearly to be seen in 2 Samuel 13:11 and following, where Amnon has forbidden intercourse with Tamar and thereby violates and degrades her status as a woman in Israel. Leviticus 23 uses this term in an idiom that was obviously rooted in the cultic life, in the sanctuary life of Israel. And it reveals a reflexive meaning. It means to afflict one's soul. That would be the literal translation. To afflict oneself. And some, because of the parallelism of the word that is used here and the word that is used for fasting in Isaiah 58:3-5, and the explanatory connection of the two words in Psalm 35:13, we can also add the idea of fasting to the realm of meaning of this term. Some are eager to point out that that more than just abstaining from food and drink is involved here, while others say it probably included fasting and perhaps other penitential exercises as well. And the Qumran documents testify to the fact that the meaning of this term describes a whole inner attitude of humility, knowledge of one's own spiritual poverty and submission to God. It also reminds of texts like Psalm 109:16-22, and 147:3, where this term is used alongside the expression the brokenhearted, and thus has a clear spiritual overtone, which perfectly fits the context of Leviticus 23 and of Daniel 10. The word is used for the required attitude of penitence and humility on the part of the people before God on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. This was such a serious matter that God warned the Israelites that everyone not taking an active part in this kind of preparation would be cut off from the people. Daniel is indeed showing this attitude in chapter 10. And I think this is also confirmed. I can only mention it here very briefly without going into further details. I think it is confirmed by the person that we meet, the heavenly person that we meet in chapter 10, the man clothed in linen, which I believe refers to services conducted on the Day of Atonement. So we have Day of Atonement motifs in chapter 10. Now I have to hurry on, but I would like to expose you to a model that I'm trying to develop, a model of thematic structure in the book of Daniel, that is informed by sanctuary themes in the book. So what I'm saying is that in the book of Daniel, we have a structure, a literary structure. We have parallels between chapters that are paralleled because of cultic terms and cultic motifs, sanctuary motifs, in those chapters. Now, there have been many studies in the scholarly realm on the structure of the book of Daniel. I don't want to tire you with the details of this now. Suffice it to say that there have been confirming statements on the structure that sees Daniel chapter 7 as the center of the book, as the hinge, as it was called, the hinge of the book that connects the two parts of Daniel, and also sees the other chapters in parallels. Chapter 1, then, is the introductory chapter, which, by the way, contains, in my opinion, samples for each category that I've listed. Maybe I can just briefly introduce them here to you. For example, there is the cultic space, that is the house of God. Secondly, there is the sacred time. And I propose, I submit, that the 10 days of testing belong to the realm of sanctuary. I'm not saying that this is all original with me, but I can't give you all the references now. But when you come to me, you can ask me, and then I will tell you who all these good people were that came up with parts of these ideas. But I'm trying to fit it all together. Sacred objects, the temple vessels that I already mentioned. Then the sacred or cultic performance, I think, is the non-defilement, the very clear decision by Daniel and his friends, we do not want to defile ourselves, which again is a term that belongs to the sanctuary realm. And also I would see Daniel and his friends as cultic persons, as persons that are very strongly related to the sanctuary idea. Now, going on from chapter 1, we have chapter 2, 7, and 12 that I think have parallel themes. And the theme here, I think, is the theme of, the theme of judgment from the sanctuary. It is generally acknowledged and not difficult to see that all three chapters talk about judgment, although only chapter 7 is the one to use the term. But I hope to demonstrate that in all three chapters, the cultic motif, the sanctuary motif, is closely linked with the judgment motif. Chapters 3 and 6 have several linguistic and literary connections, but are also linked by the common sanctuary theme of usurpation of cult and true cult. The real issue in chapter 3 and 6 is worship. And it's the usurpation of worship by those who work against God. And it is the faithful keeping of the true worship of God by those who want to be on His side. Chapters 4 and 5, whose close and parallel connection has been demonstrated already on other levels, also share the cultic theme of desecration and judgment. In both chapters, a king sets himself above God and His holiness in word, chapter 4, and deed, chapter 5. Both times, this arrogance and desecration is met with instant judgment from God. Chapters 8 and 11, interestingly enough, have a very similar theme as chapters 3 and 6. Suggesting a structural link that extends beyond the usual confinement, and I'm now talking in the scholarly realm here, the usual confinement of Daniel A, that is chapters 1 to 6, and Daniel B, which is 7 to 12. I think there are even structural links beyond that two-part division. Again, there is usurpation of cult, and this time defilement in contrast to the evidence of true cult or non-defilement in 3 and 6. The judgment motif is present in all those four chapters. Now, beyond the link between chapters 9 and 10 and the person of Daniel who mourns and fasts and understands the vision, this is stated very clearly in both chapters. You have it in Daniel 9, he mourns and fasts and understands. You have the same statement in chapter 10, he mourns and fasts and understands. Beyond that link, there's also the thematic parallel of atonement and acquittal, which is strongly related to the sanctuary motif. In both chapters, Daniel functions as the representative for his people, receiving the assurance of salvation after he has humbled himself, which, as I have shown above, is the term related to the Day of Atonement. If chapter 9 is to be interpreted as pointing to the Christ event at his first coming, which we believe, then chapter 10 reveals the warrior high priest who makes atonement on the Day of Atonement for those who show humility and believe in his strength. And this theme stands in related contrast to the one in chapters 4 and 5. Whereas there pagan kings exalt themselves above the holy God, only one of them repents and humbles himself, namely Nebuchadnezzar, and judgment from the same God meets both of them, in chapters 9 and 10 we have the reverse situation. Daniel humbles himself and pleads on behalf of his people, and God reveals to him his plan of salvation and atonement. I have attempted to show, only very briefly, I have to admit, that the whole book of Daniel has a thematic structure in concentric, chiastic, as it is called, parallel, that are determined by the sanctuary theme. And I think it will demand further studies, and I'm lucky enough to have a little bit more time in the future, I hope, to draw conclusions for the composition of the book. However, it can be said with some certainty that the book of Daniel has more coherence and unity than generally accepted. This was one of the sentences for my scholar friends at the convention there. Now, the last question that I'm asking, I'm taking from one of the papers that I heard this week. So what? Yes, I laughed too when I read it. But I said, if they can do it, I can do it too. So what? What is the significance of all this? Why do we go to great lengths to show that there's so much of the sanctuary in the book of Daniel? First of all, Daniel was a sanctuary person. I believe that he could not live and think without the sanctuary. And you just have to read Daniel 9, his prayer, and you will find this confirmed. He was just steeped into this thinking, as any Israelite was, I think. That's what I take from the Old Testament. The sanctuary service had more significance in that realm than we sometimes want to believe. At least I take that from our lack of interest sometimes. This also means it is for the end time, because Daniel, as we know, was written for the end time. This would mean that we have to live and think as sanctuary persons. Even the prophecies cannot be understood without the sanctuary. Now, this is not new with me, as you know. I mean, this we have known for many years now. The prophecies cannot be understood without a knowledge of the sanctuary, right? What would we do if we didn't have Leviticus 16 and the letter to the Hebrews? The sanctuary gives the correct perspective on Jesus' sacrifice. And hopefully, if we take it seriously, will prevent us from the mistake that other people have made, namely taking the Bible apart, as it were, taking the theology of the Bible apart, by concentrating solely on the sacrifice of Jesus and uplifting only that at the expense of the institution where the sacrifice rightfully belongs. And this, I think, gives the perspective that we need to understand our own situation in light of the sanctuary. And this also shows us, as I hope I have demonstrated, it shows us how to live during the eschatological Day of Atonement. If Daniel was not thinking it below himself to humble himself, then we should think twice about how we should live and if we can't take our cue from the life of Daniel. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.